From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now on day 35 of the government shutdown. The FAA has halted some flights at New York's LaGuardia Airport and at the airports in Philadelphia and Newark. It is a staffing problem. Air traffic controllers aren't getting paid, and now they're not coming to work. They missed another paycheck today, along with 800,000 other federal workers.
It's also a day of significant developments in the special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of possible Trump campaign collusion with Russia. The FBI arrested longtime Trump political advisor Roger Stone. It was in a raid at dawn at Stone's home in Florida. He was charged today with lying to Congress and obstructing the work of congressional investigators who were examining what he knew about hacked Democratic emails that WikiLeaks released just before the 2016 election. Roger Stone was released on a $250,000 bond today. Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. Domenico Montanaro is NPR's lead politics editor. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
And Enrique Acevedo is a Univision news anchor. Hi, Enrique.
Hi, Lisa.
I'm sorry that we don't have a lot to talk about today, but let's press on anyway. The 24-page indictment says that Roger Stone was keeping Trump campaign officials advised of upcoming WikiLeaks releases that were damaging to Hillary Clinton before the 2016 election. Domenico, first, how significant is this indictment?
Well, you know, it's significant in the sense that it's somebody who is very close to President Trump, somebody who had been an advisor to President Trump for many years, someone who was involved with the campaign in so much as him talking directly with Donald Trump. And there's big questions from this indictment on what connections, which high-ranking officials did he speak with? He used to be a partner with Paul Manafort. Could have been him. Is it President Trump? That's what a lot of people are wondering. And how much did the president know? When did he know it, in fact, is one of the questions that Jerry Nadler, one of the chairmen of the new committees in the House, a Democrat, was asking as well.
This is also a question that CNN host John Berman was asking the White House press secretary Sarah Sanders today about whether the president directed someone to stay in touch with Stone about those leaks. Let's listen.
Did the president know or not? Was it the president who made that direction or not?
Once again, I haven't read this document. Okay. I'm not an attorney. I'm not going to be able to get into the weeds on those specifics.
Okay.
What I can tell you are the charges brought against Mr. Stone have nothing to do with the president, have nothing to do with the White House.
Enrique, when you look at this indictment, is that right? This had nothing to do with the president.
It's hard to believe because the names of people close to the president keep adding up. The first circle around the president keeps being involved in this Russian interference or at least Russian communication with high-ranking officials in the campaign, with people close to the Trump world, the companies Donald Trump had before going into the White House, still has interests in. So it's hard to think the president didn't know anything about this as the names of that first circle keep adding up.
Roger Stone is now the sixth Trump advisor or campaign official to be charged in the Mueller investigation. Also this week, Senate investigators subpoenaed former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen to testify next month. We should say Paul Manafort appeared in court today. All of this is happening as the shutdown continues. And I wonder if there is any effect of the shutdown on the Mueller investigation. Domenico?
The Mueller investigation has been proceeding per usual, as far as we know. Certainly, if the shutdown were to go on much longer, it would obviously hamper everything that the Justice Department does unless funds were somehow moved around. You know, this is the longest shutdown now in U.S. history. If it were to go on for very long, then there would be potential consequences. But at this point, it seems that the Mueller investigation is going at pace.
Domenico, I just want to ask you one more question about this investigation before we move on to the shutdown. Of course, now we're starting to see big ripple effects there. But in terms of the Roger Stone investigation, another one of these big questions is whether or not he or anyone in the Trump campaign knew about what the Russians were doing with this hack beforehand. How big is that question, and do we know anything more about it?
Yeah, we don't know a whole lot more about it. It's murky at this point whether or not the Trump campaign or people surrounded with them knew exactly what was going to be released. If they knew, a bigger question is whether or not they knew WikiLeaks was functioning as Russian intelligence, you know, or as a front for Russian intelligence, as the U.S. Intelligence officials believe. So, you know, that's really kind of a bigger thing, especially when you consider in the context of Donald Trump Jr. and other senior officials having that meeting at Trump Tower in 2016 about wanting to get dirt from Russia about Hillary Clinton. And also, you know, in the context of Jared Kushner and the NBC report out today and yesterday about his top secret clearance having been initially rejected because of potential foreign influence and yet was overruled by a supervisor.
Yeah.
Enrique, I'm curious, getting back to what's happening in the skies today. As we said at the top, some air traffic controllers are not getting paid. Some of them are not coming to work. TSA workers are not getting paid, and some of them are not coming to work as well. And that's causing some chaos right now at certain airports, especially along the eastern seaboard. What kind of a bearing does this kind of action, this kind of consequence of the shutdown have on politicians in Washington and how urgently they feel about this?
I think it really brings home the magnitude of what the shutdown is causing across the country. You know, people didn't have any compassion or empathy towards what was going on in the lives of hundreds of thousands of federal workers, information like the one we're learning about today and the safety of our airspace and the safety of I guess, millions of passengers in the U.S. could really bring home the magnitude of what's happening. And I would add, this is the real failure of what's going on in Washington, of the polarization in our politics, the fact that the government can't even operate because of a political issue, because of the impasse between the Democrats and the White House and Republicans. So at the end of the day, I think, as you know, everyday people around the country just want things to work, and they just want the government to operate properly, regardless of politics.
I think that's a good point. I was just at the border earlier this week. I was talking to people literally in front of the border fence, talking to them about, you know, how they felt about this shutdown and why the politicians couldn't figure out how to get it solved in Washington. There is a real sense of confusion amongst the people I spoke with about why they can't do it. Domenico, where are we on the negotiations? I mean, after the Senate failed yesterday to pass those two bills, are we any closer or even further away from a solution?
It's not clear, you know, but it's Friday, so you never know what could happen in Washington on a Friday. And, you know, you laugh, but you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we heard from the president potentially this afternoon, especially with these flights. You know, he's looking on cable television and seeing a major corridor in the United States close to where he is from and known. I mean, when LaGuardia, Newark, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C. are all being affected by you know, potentially the shutdown and the ripples of that. That's not something that this president is – that's going to be lost on this president, being a New Yorker and understanding exactly what that means and where the blame is being placed right now, which mostly is being put on him.
So this potentially could – what's happening today speak louder to politicians, the president, and Congress than any kind of poll could, because apparently they've been reading the polls and not really felt that sense of urgency, but maybe things will change at this point. I wonder what you both make of this fiery speech that Colorado Democrat Michael Bennett gave on the Senate floor yesterday, accusing Texas Republican Ted Cruz of, quote, crocodile tears when he was talking about the current shutdown.
When the senator from Texas shut this government down in 2013, my state was flooded. It was underwater. People were killed. People's houses were destroyed. Their small businesses were ruined forever. And because of the senator from Texas, this government was shut down for politics.
Enrique, I wonder what you make of that. And perhaps it's no surprise that Bennett said this morning he's considering a 2020 presidential run.
Well, I think he channels the frustration of a vast majority of Americans in that speech, in that reaction. Why are, you know, politics getting in the way of things working the way they should? That's, you know, it's not that hard. It's not that complicated to really, you know, understand what people around the U.S. think of this shutdown. You have to know that they don't care about politics at the end of the day if they're getting in the way of their everyday lives, like going to work, getting paid, putting food on the table. Those are the priorities, and they want politicians to at least agree on the conditions that can allow that to go on. So again, it channels the frustration of most Americans with this shutdown perfectly.
Domenico, to be fair to Ted Cruz, he said afterwards that he's never been that angry on the floor of the Senate, and he hopes that he never will be. Your thoughts, finally, Rep. Domenico, you there? Looks like we might have lost Domenico Montanaro, who we'll say goodbye to him now. He's the NPR's lead politics editor. We've also been speaking to Enrique Acevedo, Univision News anchor. Enrique, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Peter. We didn't even get to Venezuela, which was also a good, interesting issue to talk about
it
today.
Definitely was. We'll get there elsewhere in the show. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Teachers and students in Los Angeles are back in class this week after a six-day strike that ended with a victory for the teachers, who negotiated, among other things, a 6% pay raise and reduced class sizes. This week in Denver, teachers voted to go on strike, but so far teachers and students are still in class. Teachers in Oakland are also considering a strike. Lily Escalin Garcia is head of the National Education Association. It represents teachers in these three cities. She's also a former teacher in Utah. Lily, welcome.
I am just thrilled to be here. It has been a very good week for us.
You've had some victories, yes. And in an era when public sector unions have been on the decline, what do you think is driving so many teachers' strikes around the country?
We're a growing union. After all the attacks on unions, especially public employee unions, and we're seeing some energy like we've never seen before.
Why is that? Is it building? Is one victory building on the next?
It actually, I think, comes from being the good teachers and support staff that we've been, trying to work through the system, saying, you know, it's not really a great idea to have 40 kids in a classroom, and here's what we need for our special ed kids, and here's sports and arts are actually important parts of our curriculum, and we were ignored. We were ignored as more and more local, state, and even the national government started saying, yeah, you guys can pick up the slack. You can buy your own supplies. So we have seen this for decades, and you can only take seeing that for so long. And our members, they have been standing up and saying, we will not be ignored when we see our students suffering.
I wonder if part of your success is that strategy that you're hinting at. As you know, there's this trend in union organizing now. It's called bargaining for the common good, which means it's not just about improving conditions for the teachers in this case. It's also about improving conditions for the students. Are your unions powerful enough to be successful without framing it that way?
The common good bargaining that you're seeing has been incredibly successful. When we talk about the wide range of things that our union is fighting for, guess what? Parents stand with us, because what we're saying is true.
Now,
and it's coming from our experience working with someone else's children. And that's what won the day in Los Angeles.
Now, that LA strike, let's talk about it. It was unique because it happened in a blue state where policymakers are typically very friendly to unions. How did that affect your negotiations in this case?
What you saw last year in that Red for Ed wave that started in West Virginia and hit Oklahoma, Arizona, these were states that were being starved from general funding from very conservative state legislatures and governors. It was very different, the dynamic in Los Angeles. We're sitting at the table, we're bargaining for our contract for this school district, and we are not only going to settle for a pay raise. And I was in Los Angeles after they announced the settlement. The largest applause line was when they said, we won. A school nurse in every school every day will have a visit from a school nurse. They were off the charts with joy for what they were getting for their kids.
The Supreme Court decided last year that public sector unions like yours cannot require non-members to pay dues. I'm sure you're very well aware of that ruling. A blow to your cause, no doubt, but have you felt the impact of the ruling yet?
For decades, we've been under attack by people like the Koch brothers and folks like them. They won their case in the Supreme Court, but when they won that, they didn't win their goal. Their goal was to have a whole lot of members drop their membership and get those services for free. Not only did that not happen, we actually saw membership growth. And look at the strength that you're seeing now and the good that's coming from our union.
Okay, well, what is next? Are we going to expect a strike in Denver?
Denver is in flux right now. No one should be predicting what's going to happen in any of these situations, because it can change with one conversation with the governor. It can change overnight or even in a few minutes. So I'm not going to be making predictions. I'm going to be saying that the voices of educators are now being taken very seriously. It's because we're fighting for the right things and the public is standing behind us.
That's Lily Eskelson Garcia. She's head of the National Education Association. It's the largest union in the country. Lily, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Okay, let's take a few minutes to talk about TV now. HBO and Showtime debuted new episodes of their most anticipated shows this past Sunday. The new additions have ramped up competition for an already competitive time slot. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now. Hey, Eric, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Great. So why is Sunday such a big night on TV in the first place?
That's a good question. I think it's a big night in TV for these premium cable channels like Showtime and HBO. And their job really is to make people feel like that $20, $15, whatever it is that people are paying, that it's worth it. So you debut the new episodes of your hottest shows on Sunday, and then you replay them multiple times during the week, and it gives the audience a chance to sort of buzz about what was in the episode, why people might want to watch it.
Right. You got to go to work on Monday and talk about it. Let's get to some of those Sunday night shows, starting with HBO's Crashing. It premiered its third season last Sunday, and it stars Pete Holmes, a comedian playing a comedian. Is it any good?
Crashing was a show that it took me a while to sort of warm up to. The premise of it was really interesting. It's based on the real life of Pete Holmes, the guy who created it and stars in it. The series now is sort of an up-close look at the struggles and the conflicts that a good person can face trying to make it. And I think this season has some really strong episodes in it. And in fact, we have a clip where he's in the middle of a college tour. And sometimes that can be tough for comics. You find yourself in a lot of sort of ego-challenging situations. So here's a little clip. Check it out.
Okay, when you bring me up, would you just make sure Pete Holmes is the last thing you say? Just like yada, 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 clubs and colleges. Pete Holmes, then I'll come out. That's important.
Okay, but I'm not introducing you.
What? What do you mean?
Last month we had a student comedy competition and first prize was opening for you.
I have an opener?
All right, that was Pete Holmes in Crashing. You're also paying attention to this new show, Black Monday. Stars Don Cheadle as a scrappy Wall Street trader in the 1980s. Let's hear a clip of that.
The Wall Street Journal called you all the number 11 trading firm on the block. And they called your man the Billy Ocean of trading.
Now, Eric, we've talked to you about this show before, but how important is it for Showtime in the context of a Sunday night?
So, I love the period-specific reference to Billy Ocean, who had a huge hit called Caravan Queen in the 80s. What's interesting to me about what Showtime and HBO and Stars in particular have to do is they have to have a stable of shows like year-round, strong shows that will make people want to pay that subscription fee and make them want to watch the channel. So Showtime has got a lineup now where it would be Shameless, Black Monday, and Smilf. So Showtime's kind of building a strong lineup before HBO steps up with its big guns. And for viewers, if you subscribe to both channels, you just get this steady stream of really interesting programming.
What do you think of Smilf? We've spoken with Frankie Shaw, who writes the program, on this show before. It had a promising first season. It's recently been plagued by controversies over sexual harassment claims. Is that coloring any of the quality of that program?
Well, I have to tell you, I was kind of dumbfounded when I watched early episodes of the new season. I think it's the second episode where she is, I think, daydreaming or sleeping and has a dream about having sexual contact with somebody who's wearing a mask that makes them look like Harvey Weinstein.
Mm.
It is awkward. Really bizarre. I know the comedy is trying to be something that's shocking. There's a sense that they're trying to show a single mother who's living life kind of on the edge and is prone to making bad decisions. But to have a scene like that in the second episode of the new season of a show where the creator has been accused of not being sensitive to issues on set and allowing harassment or even perpetrating harassment just seems like a really questionable decision.
All the shows we've been talking about seem a little bit irrelevant because, as you mentioned, later this year, Game of Thrones on Sunday night and Veep on Sunday night.
Right.
Can anyone compete with those two shows?
Well, you know, in this world where everything's on demand, I mean, what I've been advising people to do, because what happens is people see all of this programming on Sunday. So you do wind up having to have a strategy for tackling it, right? You have a couple of shows that maybe you might want to watch live. You know, for me, it's always been Game of Thrones because there's going to be so much chatter about it the next day that you want to see that stuff live. You don't want to be spoiled. And then there are a couple of shows that you get on your DVR. You know, you program them on your DVR and you watch them later. And then there's other shows that maybe you'll get to them if and when you get to them. The good news for the competitors, for Starz and Showtime, is that this is the last season for both those series. And so HBO is going to have to step up and provide some series to replace them.
Bunch of opportunity ahead.
For everyone.
All right. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks very much.
Always a pleasure.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
For the first time, we're able to assess how dangerous electric scooters can be. Electric scooters are powered by a battery pack. They can go up to 15 miles an hour, and they become a popular transportation alternative. But experts have not been able to determine their public health impact until now. Researchers at UCLA have found that 1 in 3 people in the Santa Monica area involved in an electric scooter accident were hurt so severely they needed an ambulance. Dr. Joanne Elmore is the senior author of the research. She is professor of medicine at UCLA. Dr. Elmore, welcome.
Hi.
How dangerous are e-scooters in general?
Well, we don't know how many millions of rides are occurring every day in the U.S. and internationally. But we certainly did see a few hundred patients in our emergency rooms. The injuries did vary in severity, but some of them were so severe that the patients had to be hospitalized. And in fact, we had 2 patients that we had to send up to our intensive care units.
Intensive care units for what kinds of injuries, or what are the most common ones?
Well, the most common injuries are probably fractures. But we had about 40% of the patients with head injuries. And in fact, those with mild concussions might have been discharged. The 2 patients that required intensive care unit, one of them had what's called a traumatic subarachnoid hemorrhage, and the other one had a subdural hematoma. And basically, when you fall and hit your head with such force, there can be bleeding.
So what is the most common cause of injuries that severe?
Well, what we noticed is that these individuals were either falling off of the scooters, that's the majority of them from what we could tell, or they were hitting moving objects. And in fact, we were surprised. I had assumed that all of the injuries that were seen in our 2 emergency departments would be from riders. But we actually had 8% of the patients were non-riders. They were either walking along and they tripped over the scooters that were left in a sidewalk, or someone on a scooter hit them.
So aside from the figures themselves, which are pretty daunting, what are you learning here in terms of what can prevent these injuries, the severe and the not so severe?
Well, I wish that I had a magic answer to that. I can tell you that, sadly, very few were wearing helmets, less than 5%.
And is it a requirement that helmets be worn
if you're
riding an e-scooter?
Well, according to the companies, yes.
But they don't provide a helmet when you rent an e-scooter.
Oh, they don't provide a helmet when you're riding it on the spot. But the companies do realize that they want to encourage helmet use, so it's part of your agreement when you sign up. And some of the companies are actually giving away free helmets.
And do you think that the wearing of a helmet, even if it's something that's deemed necessary by the company but not necessarily by the community, do you think that's something that could ward off some of these more severe injuries?
I do. I really do. We have data from motorcycles and from bicycles in which wearing these helmets can help to reduce the traumatic brain injury. So I really do think it could be helpful.
And what's the best thing that communities could do to reduce e-scooter-related accidents?
So I think we need to encourage riders to be careful. They need to follow local traffic laws, and they need to wear helmets to prevent the type of injuries that we've seen in our emergency departments.
Thank you very much for talking to us about the study. Dr. Joanne Elmore, professor of medicine at UCLA, director of their National Clinician Scholars Program. It's always good advice for when you're heading out for a flight, but more so today. Check with your airline about your flight status. The FAA is reporting significant delays today at New York's LaGuardia and some other airports. It's because of a shortage of workers at air traffic control facilities. NPR's David Shaper is following the story. He joins us from Chicago. What is going on, David? Which airports especially are being affected today?
Airports that seem to be most affected are New York's LaGuardia, the Newark Airport, and the Philadelphia Airport, and a few others in the Northeast. And the situation seems to be that that there hasn't been actually flights halted, but they put a ground hold on some flights. And this means that they're holding planes at the gate or on the taxiway and just trying to put more distance between planes taking off and landing, just simply because the staffing shortages at the air traffic control centers up and down the East Coast are creating a problem where they feel like to be as safe as possible, they need to slow down the takeoff and arrival of planes.
Okay, so I want to talk about the staffing shortages in a minute. But first, at one point, there was a report today that flights into LaGuardia were actually halted entirely. Did that happen?
Well, the FAA is saying no, it did not happen, that they're just instituting this hold program where they're holding back flights to and not allowing certain flights to take off or get out of the taxiway, holding them at the gates just to, again, to not unlike what happens in a weather situation where there's snow and there's winds and they need to slow down the number of planes that are taking off and landing each hour. So the FAA says it's been delays and that there is no shutdown of any airport at this point in time.
Okay, so flights are still flying. Again, people should just check before they head out, especially along the eastern seaboard. Can you say whether the air traffic control facility workers who are not coming in are making that decision because of the shutdown and because they went another payday with no check today?
Well, you know, the air traffic controllers unions and a lot of employees have been saying that this is continuing to be a problem. Here we are, you know, missing a second paycheck for many of these employees today or through this weekend. And the financial situation is getting tougher and tougher. What the FAA is saying is it's just an increase in people using sick leave. They're not specifying whether or not this staffing shortage is due specifically because of financial limitations. But that's what the TSA is actually saying now, that their employees who are using a leave and not reporting for their shifts are calling in to say, I can't work because of the financial limitations I'm facing.
This is day 35 of the partial government shutdown. I wonder if you can tell us overall how the shutdown has affected air travel.
Well, you know, up until now, it hasn't been too bad. There have been some longer lines at some airports at security checkpoints. There have been some significant delays at times because of staffing shortages at checkpoints. But we haven't seen this sort of the flight delay and potential cancellation situation yet because of shortages in the air traffic control system. But this is something that the airlines have been extremely worried about. And in fact, just yesterday, the CEO of JetBlue said that we are close to a tipping point, as many of these employees are about to miss a second paycheck. And he predicted that security lines will get longer, flights will be delayed and even canceled. And the longer this goes on, the longer it will take for the air travel system to recover.
NPR's David Shaper in Chicago. Thank you, David.
Oh, thanks so much, Lisa.
Now to another consequence of the shutdown. This week, Tom O'Connor, the president of the FBI Agents Association, said it may affect staffing at the agency.
This lack of funding to the FBI is hurting operations. It is hurting personnel across the board, and it is going to hurt our recruitment, and it is going to hurt our retention.
That concern is not just at the FBI. Our next guest says the shutdown may hamper recruitment across the entire federal government. Paul Light is professor of public service at New York University. Professor, what are your greatest concerns?
I think the shutdown may increase the retirement activity among the baby boomers. We've been predicting a quiet crisis for some decades, actually, because we saw so many baby boomers enter government back in the 1970s. The federal government is older, has an older workforce than the private sector by far. About 40% of feds are over the age of 45 compared to just 17% in the private sector. So we've got a lot of people who are in the retirement zone, and we saw an uptick last fall in the numbers who were considering retirement. We saw a 25% surge in the number of employees filing for retirement. So we may see some retirement departures, and there is going to be this retirement tsunami, as some experts call it, over the next few years. So
and
that's going to be the issue.
Have we seen this as a result of some of the other shutdowns, or are you saying that because this one is lasting so long that there might be more impetus for baby boomers to retire?
Well, there's a vulnerability here. The 1995 shutdown came when the baby boomers were sort of, well, obviously a little bit younger. This one comes when a lot of the baby boomers' older employees are at retirement age. At any rate, this one could push a lot of baby boomers out the door. Then the problem becomes who wants a federal job? And the real impact of the shutdown is at the entry level, where young Americans are considering the possibility of pursuing jobs in a government that is basically closed. December and January are big months for young people as they begin to think about what they're going to do after graduation. And my worry right now is that the next class of federal employees, younger federal employees, is going to take a pass. There's just so much uncertainty here. We've broken so many norms. And the question is, who wants a federal career? The answer from the Gen Z and millennials is not so much me.
Well,
it's a last resort, perhaps.
Maybe. I think it depends on maybe your level of education, because according to the Congressional Budget Office, federal civilian workers who have a high school education or less make 34% more when they work for the federal government than when they work for the private sector. It's different if you have a higher degree of education for those who have doctorates as well. It flips just the other way. They make more in the private sector. So for many civilian workers, a job in the federal government would look pretty good. So what's the concern?
Well, I think the concern is the quality of the work life, the uncertainty that might be attached to moving into the federal government at this particular point, the saturation in the media of stories on the very real suffering that's taken place during this shutdown. We've got another potential shutdown in September. We're talking a lot about ending this one, but we've normalized the use of shutdowns as a bargaining device. So we've got a class of young people who've got to say to themselves, okay, how do I even apply for a federal job? If you go to USA Jobs, which is the federal government's primary website for people to find and pursue careers, there's been underloading on that site in terms of new jobs. And the personnel offices, recruitment offices are closed. So for a young person saying, gee, you know, I'm going to graduate in May with this much debt, et cetera, you know, even if they did want a federal career at this particular point, it's a hard sell.
Professor Light, compare what the U.S. government had to offer, the federal government in particular, had to offer baby boomers in the past compared to what it has to offer younger workers now.
Well, you had a more rapid path towards advancement because you didn't have this big clot of baby boomers ahead. So back in the 1970s, when government was growing post-Great Society, the Environmental Protection Agency was created, we were hiring a lot of employees to build agencies from the bottom up. The pay was good. The recruitment was effective. The chance to make a difference for this country was palpable. Many of those sales pitches or sales advantages for the federal government are no longer in place. And right now, pay and benefits, the president is a diehard advocate of pay freezes, hiring freezes. We don't even have a good complement of people in the personnel offices to make the recruiting calls.
And you're saying the shutdown makes matters even worse.
Absolutely.
Paul Light, professor of public service at New York University. Thank you for speaking with us.
Very welcome.
That is not a scene from an Alfred Hitchcock movie. That's what it sounds like every day in downtown Nampa, Idaho, where more than 10,000 crows have taken up residence for the past three winters. The birds spend their days scavenging for food at nearby farms, and then they come to the city at night to roost on power lines and in grocery store parking lots. And they're not just a nuisance, they're a health hazard. So the city has asked for the public's help managing the problem, and heading up that effort is Bobby Sanchez. He's chief of staff for the city of Nampa, just west of Boise. Bobby, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having us on the show here and helping us tell our story.
Sure. And, you know, we heard what they sound like. What's it like to be there in the midst of all those crows?
Well, as I'm standing here at City Hall and looking up in the sky, they're actually flying over City Hall. They do this every morning. Their pattern is they a little bit after sunrise, they'll head out to the farm fields. And so it's kind of like every day have an opportunity to watch a little bit of the birds, the Alfred Hitchcock movie.
And I'm afraid for you to look up. You know, you need to take shelter there, I think. So what is it about Nampa that these birds like so much?
That's the number one question that we ask ourselves as we put forward this very deliberate and methodical approach to gain clarity and understanding about what attracts them here to Nampa. We believe our assumption is that they're attracted here because it provides this kind of hybrid of natural and man-made habitat along with food sources. You know, ultimately, the end game will be to answer another question is, can we construct perhaps a habitat that is equally desirable by the crows, and then over time move them to that location where they can literally roost in peace.
Have they been causing problems? You know, the city is saying this is a public health hazard.
Potentially, the health hazard is the result of the mess that they produce. Other things that we experience on a daily basis is that they can cause structural damage. The trees that they roost in, they can break branches, and the buildings that they roost on top of, they can cause structural damage.
Wow.
But the bottom line, there is a health hazard that is associated with the mess they produce.
Okay, so you've been coordinating this crow patrol, for lack of a better word, to get these birds out of those trees and off of those buildings. And you've got some pretty cool technology. You're using drones and lasers to do that. And you've also got sounds like this one. It's a crow in distress to scare the birds away. So that's interesting. What's been the best trick that you've got up your sleeve so far?
Well, you're absolutely right that we've been very innovative in our crow management approach. We like to say in the city of Nampa that we are very crow active in how we address the crow challenges. So we brought together a group that was comprised of community members, and we began to put some structure around a plan for this year, how we can keep them out of the downtown area, all within the context of being respectful of nature and our environment while meeting the needs of our business owners and community.
And you're not shooting these birds, right? You tried
no,
that. And
no,
that
we absolutely are adamant about using non-lethal techniques to manage the crow challenge. And so a lot of those things that you mentioned earlier about the infrared lasers, the noisemakers, the drones have been techniques that we've employed this year, mainly just to see how effective they would be. So this year, you know, the thought process is let's just try all these things, see how they work, learn from that, and put some meat on the bones to our plan. So as we move forward, we can really share that information, not just with our business owners and residents here in Nampa, but the other municipalities out there that might be struggling with the same kind of challenge. We can say here in the city of Nampa, these are the things that seem to be working well.
But you have a tough adversary. Crows are known as being very smart little creatures.
Yeah, they're very intelligent, very, very adaptive. And so here's the one thing. Here's the bottom line with this challenge is that as complex as this challenge might be, it is just an incredible complex situation when you factor in Mother Nature, because Mother Nature will always have a vote.
Right. I mean, crow management is not really in your job description as the city chief of staff, but like, I just wonder if part of you is kind of enjoying this new project that you're in charge of.
I love the challenge. I love to solve problems. It really is an opportunity for us to work together with the community to, in a collaborative way, come up with solutions that will work in the best interest of everyone concerned. So it becomes a win-win situation. That's the goodness in all of this, is our community coming together in a way that creates and adds value to our community.
Okay. Before I let you go, I'm sorry, but I got to do this one more time.
Music to my ears.
Bobby Sanchez, you have your hands full there with 10,000 crows descending upon the city this time of year. Good luck on the Crow Patrol. Thanks for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for having us on the show, and thank you for helping us tell our story.
And credit to the Idaho Statesman newspaper for bringing us the sound of those crows.
Kind of makes you want to duck, though, when you hear that.
Definitely. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.